see you all this morning. We appreciate you coming out today. It looks like a lot of folks are back with us today, so that's good. If you didn't get a handout this morning, raise your hand and let us know. If you didn't get one, we'll make sure you do. I think everybody did on the way by. Very good. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 12 today. Jeremiah chapter 12, and this is a shorter passage, and it's also kind of a pause in the middle of message. I'm not going to give a review for the whole book. He's preaching in this section. Jeremiah is preaching to the nation of Judah about their sin. He's called out their spiritual unfaithfulness and that they could have returned and they didn't. And in spite of their religiousness, they still have a lot of things that they need to work on. They didn't undo them by going to church and doing the things and doing the sacrifices because they still had a problem in their heart. And so what he does in this sermon, which was in chapter 11, is he points out the covenant. He says, the problem that we're having is not that I've just decided to respond in a harsh way. He says, we've already made I've already set out all the terms of our relationship long before now. He did it with the very first generation of the nation of Israel. He did it again with the second generation. And he would repeat that through his prophets, through every part of their history. And he tells them that. But even still, Jeremiah's generation had it repeated to them. They had kind of lost it in times past, and it got brought up again, and they read the book of the law in front of the people, this group of people. When their king found it, they read the book, and all the people agreed. They said, yeah, let's do that. And so these people have agreed to these terms, that God would bless them if they followed him, and he would not if they didn't. And so he says, here we are. This is the covenant. So everything makes sense, generally. Everything makes sense on paper, but it's still hard when you're living through it. I mean, we can see that in our nation at the same time, too. We can look around us and recognize that our nation as a whole is not living the way they should. And we can just walk down the street or walk through the city and just see the sin that just incorporates itself into every area of life. And so we can understand on paper for sure that God would not bless us, but at the same time, we have plenty of complaints about the way that our life is. We have plenty of annoyances about the way that the world is today around us. And we can also be bothered by how God has chosen to not bless our nation. So what happens here is Jeremiah has a complaint. Now, he gives it in a very he approaches it in the way that he should, and we'll talk about that in just a second, but he stops the message to the people and he has a private conversation with God, and that's what happens in chapter 12. He says something to God and then God says something back to him. And so that's what we're going to read this morning. I'm just going to separate it into two sections. I was actually going to make point number one just the introduction, but then there were several things I wanted to say and it became point one, so here we are. But we're going to talk about Jeremiah's complaint. And then we're going to talk about God's response. So that's where we're going to be in point number one, is Jeremiah's complaint. I want to read the first four verses and understand what he says, and I want to learn some things from it. Very short chapter, so it won't be hard to get through. But Jeremiah chapter 12, verse number 1, he says this: righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee. Yet let me talk with thee of thy judgments. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are all they happy that deal with very treacherously? Thou hast planted them. Yea, they've taken root. They grow. Yea, they bring forth fruit. Thou art near in their mouth. They're quick to identify with you, but far from their reins, from their heart, what controls their life. So you're near in what they say, but far in what they do and what they really believe. Verse 3. But thou, O Lord, know me. Thou hast seen me and tried my heart toward thee. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell therein? The beasts are consumed and the birds because they say, he shall not see our last end. So Jeremiah is a godly man. He sees the wickedness of the nation around him, and he also sees how his nation's not blessed. And he has a proposal because he's confused about the way this is coming out. Generally, the principle makes sense. Our people are wicked, our land's not blessed. Good. But the way this is coming out doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Because he says, because when I look around, the people who are doing the wicked things, they personally seem like they're doing fine. Like the people who are actually instilling the wickedness into our culture, they're living in their nice house, their nice job, they have all their money. Something doesn't seem right. Okay, I get it. Wicked people, wicked nation, not blessed nation, but the wicked individuals seem fine. They've been planted, he says. They've taken root. They bring forth fruit. And this is that's not an accidental illustration he's using. Because remember, it was just the chapter ago where he was talking about how because the nation isn't blessed, they will be plucked up rather than planted. And he's saying, so while everything around us is falling apart and when the nation is being plucked up by the roots, he says the people that are being planted by the roots, by you, are the people who are living wickedly. And we can feel that way too, can't we, sometimes? We look around, we watch the news, and we're like, wow, our nation's bad, and it's definitely not being blessed the same that it used to be. And yet we are most frustrated by the fact that the people who are seeming to do the worst are the ones who seem the most blessed. They still have their big house, they still have all their money, and they still have all their prestige, and they still have their platform, and it just doesn't seem right. And so Jeremiah has a proposal. Why don't you just pull all those people out, and then the nation will be good again? That's how we feel too sometimes, don't we? Generally, we understand wicked nation, not blessed nation. But if we just kind of pulled all the wicked people out that are being blessed, then maybe we'd be a whole lot better. And that's his proposal. We can also often have the same cry and feel that Jeremiah has in this moment. The people causing all the problems seem fine. Why don't you just pluck them out and the nation can be blessed again? He finishes his statement, verse number 4. He says, look, the land's doing horribly because of these wicked people. And he says, because they say, he shall not see our last end. They walk around like God doesn't see what they're doing. But you do see what they're doing. And I know you do. And yet, they are in their big house and with their fancy cars and their big platform and all their money. And it doesn't seem right, Jeremiah says. Very quickly, I want us to learn a couple things from Jeremiah's complaint before we get to God's response. First of all, letter A, recognize that God is right, even when you don't understand. I love how he introduces it. Now, it's very tempting to look in how Jeremiah starts this conversation and poke at him for it. Righteous art thou, O Lord, in all when I plead with thee, yet let me talk with thee of thy judgments. I just thought that was so humorous when I opened this chapter at the beginning of the week. God, you're right in all that you do, but let me have a conversation with you about some of the things you've been doing. And we feel that way, but at the same time, I can hardly fault Jeremiah for making this statement because the fact is, can I fault Jeremiah for not knowing the answers to all of his questions? I mean, no. He is confused about what God has decided. His judgments, this is the judgment that God has made. As the judge of all the earth, this is the decision he has made. This is how he's decided to regulate things right now. That is his judgment. So I'm not surprised, nor can I say it's wrong for Jeremiah to not understand. It's not wrong for us to not be all-knowing. It's not wrong for us to not be all-wise. It's not wrong for us to not be all-powerful and not be able to take care of everything. So I'm not surprised that Jeremiah doesn't understand what God does any more than I'm surprised that sometimes we don't understand why God does what he does. But he starts it the right way. He says, righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee. He begins
correctly.
Now, I have questions, Jeremiah says. I have concerns, he says. I'm confused, he says. But I do know this. Whatever you say in response to what I have to say will be right. We are going to have to come to, and honestly, Jeremiah does what he should do with his questions and his concerns and his confusion. He takes them to God. God, I don't understand, so I'm going to talk with you about them. Now, there is a little bit here I'm gonna pick at Jeremiah with. He does seem to be slightly accusing in what he says. But still, this is the way we should approach God as well. We are going to be confused. And a lot of us harbor a confusion and we blame God inside and never actually take it to him. We are going to be concerned. We are going to have moments where we don't understand. The best thing to do with all that is to go to God with them, but to recognize that God is right in whatever he will say. It's not wrong to not know everything. It's wrong to say that God is wrong. I just preached on Psalm 19 to the teenagers just this past week on Wednesday. And Psalm 19 is very familiar with me because it's a very important passage in all the Bible that basically says this point, that no matter where you are, no matter who you are, God has communicated to you that he is God. All people. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, night unto night shows knowledge. There is no speech or language, their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So he says, God has communicated to all people and to all languages that he is God. Now I knew that, but I didn't know the rest of the psalm. Now what I was expecting Psalm 19 to do was to then explain how great God was. You know, one of those psalms. And so he is powerful, and so he is great, and so he's the creator. But that's not where Psalm 19 goes. He goes from everybody knows very clearly and on purpose that God is God, and he's the creator of all things. And what does he do with that truth in the rest of the psalm? I gave you some of it. Verse number 7 of Psalm chapter 19. I think it's in your handout. He says, the law of the Lord is perfect. This is where he goes right from that. Converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is thy servant warned, and in keeping of them is great reward. What does he do with the information at the beginning of the psalm that everybody should know that God is God? What does he do with that? He says, if God is God, then God is right. I'm not. Suddenly, in our short speck of time we've existed on this earth, we feel like we have the license to go to God and accuse him as if he misunderstood the situation. Because we had it all together, and it's so obvious to us what should be done. And so Jeremiah approaches correctly. God, you are righteous in all that you've judged, but I do have questions that I am concerned about, and he brings them to him. God is right whenever we don't understand. Letter B, do not accuse God of being unjust, or inform God as if he does not understand. Do not accuse God of being unjust or inform God as if he does not understand. There's a little bit of that in what Jeremiah says. Verse number 1, he says, let me talk with you. And then he says, wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously? Thou hast planted them. They have taken root, they grow, yea, they bring forth fruit. Thou art near in their mouth and far from their reins. But thou, O Lord, knowest me, thou hast seen me and tried mine heart toward thee. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. He says, why are you letting them go to get away with it? Why are they being blessed? Stop it. Pull them out. Let them be the sacrifice and not the nation around them. Now, the assumption behind what Jeremiah is saying is that what we're dealing with is less than ideal, obviously. The wicked prosper, and I, whom righteous, I'm suffering. He says, so judge them instead of the rest of us. But what is Jeremiah saying? It's hard to find out exactly what he's implying, but he's either implying one of two things. He's either implying that God is purposefully doing something that is unjust, or he's accidentally allowing something that is unjust. Either way, he's accusing God of not having everything under control or not doing it right. Because he's saying, these are the way things are, and this is what you should be doing instead. And those are the things we flip back and forth with God. We don't understand what he does. We either accuse him of not being all-powerful, or we accuse him of not being good. This is what the atheists accuse God of doing. The moment we don't understand something that God does, we accuse him of being all-powerful or not all-good. There's a whole conversation in that discussion about a certain kind of evil, which is a name that I always don't pronounce right. I could spell it for you, but I'm a homeschooler, and I always mispronounce things that I read. But the point of it is this. Is there actually a type of evil that just has no value? We all know that some bad things that happen have value. Like when you punish your kid, it's a bad situation, but there's value because they're disciplined, and then they'll know not to do it. Or when we put our hand on the stove, there's pain. There's value in that pain because now I know that that will hurt me, so I don't do it next time, right? And so when we look at the world, we know there's value in some pain. But then there's the question of whether or not there are some things going on in our world that just have no value at all. They're just bad. They're just a bad situation, and there's nothing gained from it at all. And the response to that is we're not even in a position to know if that's true. As if we know whether or not God can make something good out of something bad. If we're in a position to know that God is actually in control of the situation, or if this is just bad and that's all that it is. Because we don't know everything that's going on. That's the point. We don't know what God is doing. We're not sitting on the throne. We're not in a position to judge whether or not what we think God should do is actually better than what God is doing right now. All we can see is today and tomorrow. And so because all we can see is today and tomorrow, we accuse God of being unjust or unpowerful because we would do something different because our idea of what should be done is obviously better than God's idea of what should be done. Don't accuse God. Letter C, remember that God's time is not your time. God's time is not yours. Verse number 4, how long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell therein? How long? This is a question that comes up a lot in the Bible. Because we're very, very impatient people. It starts from when we're a child. Right now, Levi is starting to notice that we exist when we're not in the room. And so this is a new thing, that he realizes that we're not there, and he knows we're somewhere else. And he gets very upset when we're not there. We're trying to teach him okay to be alone for a few minutes, and that's all right. But he cries like we have left him there for 3 weeks, I promise you. He gets up in the morning, he sits and he plays, and then all of a sudden he starts to scream. And you could hear in his mind like he's trying to scream the loudest he can possibly muster. Like, and then he starts to cough. And I look at him and I was like, yeah, I'd cough too if I screamed that loud. And But he reacts like, why have you left me for so long? How long must I be in this situation of abandonment? And we act that way too. We understand things. We have more patience, but we're not very patient people. And so whenever we have to deal with something that's less than ideal for any length of time, we say, how long must it be this way? The Bible informs us very, very carefully that when God does something, he does it at the right time. I gave you a couple verses. The first one I gave you was Galatians 4:4. This is an interesting phrase the Bible uses. I'm not going to give you a lot of context of the background of this because I'm not going to try to preach from Galatians. But simply what Paul is saying here is he's talking about the time that Jesus came. And I've asked this question before. Why did Jesus come when he came? Why didn't he come during the Maccabean period when the Greeks were in charge? Why didn't he come right when they came back to the land and they rebuilt the temple? Why didn't he come here? Why did he come at, you know, 0 AD or 4 BC, depending on who you ask, and during the Roman occupation. Why then? And we can speculate, and I have some very strong opinions about some things, but that's what they are. They're opinions about why. But the Bible said he came, in Galatians 4:4, he came in the fullness of time. And we can sit there and say why it was the best time, but the Bible just tells you, you know what, it's not really important that you know why it was the best time, but it was. And there was people for hundreds of years saying, Lord, how long till the Messiah comes? Of course, he shows up and half of them don't believe that he's there, but they spent the whole time saying, why isn't he coming? And God says he came in the fullness of time, when it was the most beneficial time for him to come. For all things concerned, that's when he did it. But we waited. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip and drop that in, just so we know who's here this morning, we'd appreciate that. I gave you one other verse. Same thing happens now. Same thing happens now. People say, Jesus isn't coming back. He's been gone for a long time. And then they say, scoffers come. Where is the promise of his coming? Since the beginning, all things continue as they have been. Jesus isn't coming back. Why? Because we wonder, how long till he returns? Actually, that exact question is posed to God in heaven, in the book of Revelation, before he returns the second time. They say, how long will you not judge and avenge our brothers and those who dwell on the earth? And 2 Peter 3 answers that. And in the middle of the conversation, it gives a very important verse that we've all heard before. And it says, one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. That's where that verse is. Where people are saying, God, how long? How long do we have to wait until these important things come? And he says, just so you know, God doesn't actually wait. You ever thought about that? He doesn't wait for things. He doesn't watch the seconds tick. God is eternal. And he looks on all time and he says, here, this is the best time to do it. We wait. He doesn't wait. He doesn't have to, you know, have you ever waited for something and you're trying to be patient and then you just went early anyway because you couldn't wait any longer? God doesn't do that because he knows the best time. And this is exactly what he says in 2 Peter as well. God's not on your timetable. So he'll pick the fullness of time, not the best time. And every issue we have in our life, we complain to God that he's waiting too long, but God's not waiting at all. God, we expect God to fix every problem in our life in the quickest time, but God works in our life in the fullness of time. So Jeremiah says, how long? And God's going to say, in the right time. Letter D. Remember, when we accuse God, remember that no one is truly innocent. No one is truly innocent. Verse number 4. How long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell therein? The beasts are consumed and the birds because they say, he shall not see our last end. Now, this isn't completely unfair. But Jeremiah's whole proposal is based on this assumption. Our nation is not being blessed because of the wicked people as opposed to all of the other good people who deserve it to be blessed. There's an assumption that it's always their fault. Jeremiah was a good guy, and I feel like if anybody in Israel could make a complaint, it would be him. But yet, implicit in this understanding is that the wicked people are always those people. You ever notice that? No matter who they are, watch like any news commentator, the wicked people are those people. The wicked people is never these people. It's always those people. And that's how we seem to be wired to live our lives. The bad people are them. And I understand, you know, I got some things to work on, but they were pulled out as sheep for the slaughter, then the nation would prosper. I'll work with me. That's fine. We'll go from there. But those people. And the Bible says none of us are good. None of us deserve God's blessings. We think we do. God owes us a nation that's comfortable. And the fact is, maybe there's a lot of things that we should be working on. Maybe the reason why God's blessing is actually partly due to the stuff we have been doing. Oh, the stuff that's not that important, you know, oh, the bad stuff is what they're doing. I'm doing the stuff that's excusable, right? That's why, like, pastor's messages the last couple weeks especially have been helpful to us, because he's mentioned a couple different times. These are the things that we don't think are a big deal. And yet they're thrown in right along with the rest of the curses. Taking advantage of people or not being completely honest. Those things that we just pass off as just everyday life, he says, I can't bless. But we always have this symptom of looking at everybody else. Just last night, well, I'll back the story up. A couple weeks ago, I was outside trying to get my lawnmower to start. Did, by the way, so that was good. But people walked by very slowly on the street in our little townhouse community with a clipboard. And that's always a little nerve-wracking. We have an HOA. We have a new HOA now. And so you never know what they're going to do, who they're going to be like. So apparently when they were walking by with their clipboard, they were looking for, I don't know, infractions of not taking care of your neighborhood, which I first thought, well, that's good, because some people need to really work on their house. You know, that one guy, he has that tarp over his garage door because he has too much stuff in his garage. He needs to close that up. And that other person who has dog poop in their yard because they haven't picked it up recently, they need to get on them. And that one guy never mows his lawn, so he's gotta make sure he mows his lawn. And so a couple weeks pass, last night, and I get a letter in the mail. And I'm thinking, do you realize what my house looked like when I bought this house? I had a bush that couldn't see the front door. I had stones and that landscape material that's supposed to cover up the weeds was just amongst the weeds in my front yard. I took care of all of those. I had mud and weeds in my backyard. Now it is a beautiful patio. I have a beautiful house. But no, I get a letter in the mail saying, you know, you need to power wash the side of your house. And I'm looking, I was like, I mean, it's not that bad. But we have in our townhouse community, all the houses, the side that faces north gets that green stuff on it. It does, and especially because we were close together, so it gets the right kind of sun to get it. And I noticed that a bunch of the neighbors in the neighborhood had all gotten the same letter. So I felt a little less bad. But my initial response was, we're all thinking, well, when he came through the clipboard, what I wanted is him to tell the guy with the garage door to take the tarp off his, and I wanted him to pick up all the dog poop, and I wanted him to mow his lawn, but my house is fine. Mine is excusable. Why are you getting on me? And that's how we deal with all of those things, don't we? We sit in church, and God says something to us, and we're like, yeah, but if I came to church, I wanted you to fix that guy and those people and them. But I'm not that bad. Leave me alone. Who are you? And that's how we respond to all things. And even though Jeremiah is living right, that's how we respond. And watch, everyone responds that way. And when everyone responds that way, you know what happens? Nothing gets fixed. Because it's always them and never me. So remember that nobody is innocent, and just fix what you have. So that was Jeremiah's complaint. What's God's response? Number two. There's a couple things that he says that are helpful, and we'll go through these very quickly. Letter A. This is interesting. I can't believe this is the first thing that God says to him, but he does. Letter A. It can easily get worse than it is. This is how he responds to Jeremiah. Now, before you think, well, Jeremiah's situation is really, really bad, remember the timeline. If you your handout's open, you can glance at the timeline. Where we are in the book of Jeremiah right now is still during the reign of Josiah, the very first king. Josiah is a good king, as really good as anyone has been for a really long time. He brought out the law. The people have made a covenant to follow it. They're not, but that's like the political climate that they're in. Babylon and any foreign nation right now, Egypt isn't giving them a hard time. Babylon isn't there right now. The temple is standing. Their cities are standing. Their walls are standing. This is a situation that Jeremiah is in now. Okay, and he's complaining that the whole nation is falling apart. And God, before actually responding to Jeremiah's question, basically tells him, before you start complaining about the situation you're in, it's going to get a lot worse. This, he says something interesting. Look what he says, verse 5. If thou hast run with the footmen, and they've wearied thee, then how canst thou contend with horses? And if in the land of peace wherein thou trustest they wearied thee, then how wilt thou do in the swelling of Jordan? Even thy brethren in the house of thy father, even they have dealt treacherously with thee. Yea, they've called a multitude after thee. Believe them not, though they speak fair words unto thee. So verse number 6 talks about how his family is dealing with him and that's a problem. But verse number 5 is really where this point comes out. He gives it two illustrations. He says, suppose, Jeremiah, you were in a race on foot, and you were running with another guy on foot, and you were losing. What makes you think that you're going to win the race if you're running against a horse? If you're weird with the footmen, what makes you think you can contend with horses? He gives another illustration. If you're having trouble living in peace in the land of peace, then what makes you think you'll do well in the swelling of Jordan? Now, that probably doesn't mean anything to us. The swelling of Jordan is an area near the Jordan River. Two times in the book of Jeremiah, I don't know why, but two times in the book of Jeremiah later on, he equates the swelling of Jordan with a place where lions are. So I think this is just a place where wild beasts are. It's a little less urban, and it's just more wild, and there's more danger there, okay? So simply, all that point is making, and he would know that without God having to define it, because he knows what the land's like. So simply, the point is this. If you're having trouble with peace, what makes you think you'll do fine in the wilderness? Point simply being this. Jeremiah, you're having trouble right now. But the fact is, things can get worse than they are. And what we often tend to do is we do exaggerate our situation. We always think that whatever we are living in is the worst it could possibly be. Now, Jeremiah is in a bad situation right now. He's preaching. Nobody's listening to him. His own hometown had a brief meeting where they wanted to try to get rid of Jeremiah and take his life. But if we know the story of Jeremiah, his situation will get worse. He's walking around free on the streets. There's going to be a huge portion of Jeremiah thrown in a dungeon, like a dungeon. Right now, the land is in peace. Everything is standing. And we know from the book of Jeremiah, there will come a time where he will walk out into the street and everything is broken down and lying on the ground in pieces. And he will mourn for the nation. The book of Lamentations is Jeremiah lamenting about looking around at his nation and everything's burning and falling apart, a heap of rubble. And so, yes, Jeremiah is not in a spot that is ideal. But God reminds him before he starts complaining too much that it can always be worse than it is. And the fact is, we as Christians, we get overwhelmed by our situation and our nation. Our nation is getting worse, and that's for sure. But sometimes we can be so overwhelmed by our complaint that we forget that we could be in a lot worse spot than we are. Our job that we complain about every day could be a lot worse than it is. Our family or our spouse that we complain about not being who they should be, they could be a lot worse than they are. And we're in a spot where sometimes God has to remind us, hey, you need to count the blessings you do have because you might not have them for very long or you might have them back, but you could have less than you do have. And we always take whatever it is that we do have for granted and complain for everything we don't have. That's just the nature of it. If we had more, we wouldn't thank God for it. We would just complain about the leftovers that we don't have still. And that's just the way that we are. And this is what Jeremiah, and so God responds to him, if you can't deal with this now, Jeremiah, you're not going to be able to make it to the end of your journey because the rest of your journey is difficult. That's how God responds to his complaint. Sometimes God's straightforward with us, isn't he? And so he says, this is really hard. Yeah, Jeremiah, it's going to get worse though. It's going to get worse. And that's true. Letter A, it's going to easily get worse than it is. Letter B, this is where he really answers the question. Consequences are proportionate to the rejection of the Lord. The consequences are proportionate to the rejection of the Lord. He's not being more harsh than is fair. That's simply what he's going to say here. So, well, look at my nation, it's the people. If you just got rid of the wicked people, then it'd all be fine. And what he wants to communicate to Jeremiah is, the people have rejected me. Some people are living wickedly outwardly, and then you have the group that you just preached your message to in the temple. Who were there, who were bringing their sacrifices, who were praying, who wore their right clothes, who acted the right way, who said the right thing, but their heart was uncircumcised. And he just finished his last sermon saying, the world is uncircumcised in flesh, you are uncircumcised in heart, all of you have rejected me one way or the other. Sometimes you look like it, sometimes you don't, but it's still the same when it comes to what really matters. And so he communicates to that him to the, that to him once again. Verse number 7. God says, I've forsaken mine house. I've left mine heritage. I've given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. Mine heritage, his people, is unto me as a lion in the forest. It crieth out against me. Therefore have I hated it. It's an interesting picture. A lion sitting, crouching, and roaring at its prey or roaring at its enemy. He said, that's what my people are doing to me. They are growling at me as I am the enemy, as if they're rejecting me. Verse 9. My heritage is unto me as a speckled bird. The birds round about are against her. Come ye, assemble all the beasts of the field, come to devour. The picture here is actually more simple than it sounds. When one bird is off, it's odd. It's different than the rest of them. Then they will reject it and maybe push it out of the flock or whatever. And he's saying, my people are like that, and the nations around them are going to come against her like beasts. And so he's talking about the consequences they're going to have. The nations are going to come against them and reject them. Rather than build camaraderie, rather than have good political alliances, they are going to be alone. Verse number 10, many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They've trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. The people who were supposed to care for the people of the land have been more responsible for destroying it than making it better. Verse number 11, they've made it desolate, and being desolate, it mourneth unto me. The whole land is made desolate because no man layeth it to heart. Why is the nation falling apart? Why is everything not being what it should be? Because when I have spoken to them, they have not taken it seriously. They haven't laid it to heart. Verse number 12. So the spoilers are come upon all high places through the wilderness. For the sword of the Lord shall devour from the one end of the land even to the other end of the land. No flesh shall have peace. But they're going to try to continue on and be blessed. So they sow wheat, but they shall reap thorns. They've put themselves to pain, but shall not profit. They shall be ashamed of your revenues because of the fierce anger of the Lord. The last verse simply says this. They're going to try to go on without God's blessings. So they'll get up in the spring, and they'll go out and they'll sow their fields and expect a harvest so that they can provide for their nations all on their own. But because God's not blessing them, they're not going to be blessed by their own hand. So they will go out and they will sow wheat, but they will reap thorns. They will go out and labor. They will be in pain, but not actually have anything to show for it, and be ashamed for what they have to show for it. It reminds me of Haggai, where he says, because God wasn't blessing them, because they were setting themselves before God by building their houses and not God's house. He says, you've sown much, but you bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there's none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag of holes. And he says that's the response when we try to live without God. He says, they have rejected me, so they will live without my help. Jeremiah, you want me to act as if these people are not rejecting me, but they are. Jeremiah, I know you love these people, but I have made a covenant not to bless the lifestyle they are living. And you're asking me to go back on my word and still bless sin. And I can't do that. So, consequences, Jeremiah, are proportionate to their rejection of the Lord. I'm not being unfair, God's saying. They made the covenant. This is the response. We've already made this deal. And for us to try to make them look better than they are is not the way to respond to the situation. Just like when you give somebody the gospel, You can't lead somebody to the Lord unless the person finally admits that they're lost. And the way to get them to Christ is not to try to make them into being something they're not. That's the worst way to get there. And that's what he tells Jeremiah. Jeremiah, just remember, these people are living this way. The nation is filled with this. All kinds of people, the ones who look good and the ones who don't. And so the way to respond is not to ask God to bless it anyway, just because. Number three, but he finishes with something encouraging, which is good and odd for the book of Jeremiah. So let's savor it as we go through. Number three, just as judgment comes to all who turn from God, blessing comes to all who turn to God. So what he does here at the end is he turns to the heathen nations. He's been talking about Israel, but what about them? This was Habakkuk's response. Habakkuk lived during the same time as Jeremiah, and he was saying, you know, God, I understand the nation is wicked. I get that. I'm with you. But the Babylonians are worse, so why are they allowed to actually be the ones blessed in order to judge the people? And he says something similar to Jeremiah. Verse number 14. Thus saith the Lord against all mine evil neighbors that touch the inheritance which I've caused my people Israel to inherit. Behold, I will pluck them out of their land and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. And it shall come to pass after I've plucked them out, I will return and have compassion on them and bring them again, every man to his heritage and every man to his land. He simply says this, I'm not blessed, I am blessing the other nations. I am blessing the wicked nations. Now, not forever, now, because there's something I'm doing with them. But they will be too, for their own wickedness. And I will bring my people out and will bring them back. People throughout the Bible have been concerned why the wicked are prospering. I gave you a couple passages. I'm not going to read them for sake of time. Job says the same thing. Why are the wicked prospering and I'm not? Why is everything happening to me even though I'm the one doing what's right? Asaph says the same thing in Psalm 73. He was envious at the foolish when he saw the prosperity of the wicked. But the short-sightedness of that complaint that the wicked are doing well makes us think that the wicked end well. And they don't. Because the Bible also informs us in Psalm 34, evil shall slay the wicked, and they that hate the righteous shall be desolate. Proverbs 13 says, evil pursueth sinners, but to the righteous good shall be repaid. And he reminds Jeremiah of that. Just because they're doing fine now doesn't mean they're going to do fine later. I'm using them now for my purpose, but they will be pulled down as well. So that's the judgment that comes to all to turn from God, both the heathen and his people. But then he even goes, talking about the heathen, he says one more thing before he finishes. Verse 16 of Jeremiah 12, and we'll be done. It shall come to pass if they diligently learn the ways of my people. So he's not talking about his people. He's talking about those people. If they will diligently learn the ways of my people to swear by my name, the Lord liveth, as they taught my people to swear by Baal, then shall they be built in the midst of my people. But if they will not obey, I'll utterly pluck up and destroy that nation, saith the Lord. He said, just as I've destroyed my people because of their wickedness, I will pluck them up as well. But just as I have blessed my people for following me, I will bless them as well. Those people who you think are lost causes, those people who have lived in wickedness, they have a chance to return to God also. And he says, and so if they come, they learn the ways of my people, then I will plant them with my people. And he does. Think of Rahab, the harlot. She chose to follow God, and so she was planted in Israel. Ruth, the Moabite, chose to follow God, so she was planted in Israel. They were from heathen nations, but they chose to come, and so God accepted them. At the end of the day, there's not this color of skin and that color of skin, that nation and this nation, those that are loved and chosen from God and those who are rejected from God. There's two kinds of people that he says here at the end. C.S. Lewis said it this way. In the ends, there's only two kinds of people. There are those that say to God, thy will be done, or those to whom God says, thy will be done. And he says, at the end of the day, it's your choice. The nations, my nation, other nations, if they chose to follow me, then I will accept them. And if they choose not to, then I won't. And so he said, Jeremiah, Don't complain that the nation is experiencing the consequences that I've already said, because this is what follows. Keep preaching to them that they return, but that is the way back to me, not to make us into something that we're not. And so he answers the complaint, so next week he's going to have an illustration, one of his first illustrations, actually, in the book. And so we're going to look at that next week in chapter 13, so he'd come back for that.